With the news of the third massive appearance of the flying saucers in 1950, the Foo Fighters reappeared on the scene, this time cited by ufologists as proof that Martian observers were present in the skies during the last war. Since the idea of extraterrestrial observers clashes with the most elementary horse sense, let us rummage about for a while among the German secrets of the last days of the war, with special reference to that category of secrets which, for reasons of military expedience, even today preserves in whole or in part its shadowy and malefic character. In the autumn of 1944 in Oberammergau in Bavaria, the OBF, an experimental center run by the Luftwaffe, had completed a series of researches into electrical apparatuses capable of interfering with the operation of an engine up to a maximum distance of about 100 feet by producing intense electromagnetic fields. If the ignition of a plane's engine could be short-circuited, the plane would be bound to crash. In order to make the invention a practical proposition, the German technicians proposed to at least triple the radius of action of this weapon. But when the conflict ended, researches along those lines had barely been sketched out. In the meantime, as a byproduct of these researches that could be put to immediate use in the war, another center, run by Speer and the SS Technical General Staff, had adopted the idea of, quote, of employing, quote, proximity radio interference, unquote, on the very much more delicate and hence more vulnerable electronic apparatuses of the American night fighters. Thus, a highly original flying machine was born. It was circular and armored, more or less resembling the shell of a tortoise, and was powered by a special turbojet engine, also flat and circular, whose principles of operation recalled the well-known allopile of Hero, which generated a great halo of luminous flames. Again, the description, as Vesco says, thus a highly original flying machine was born. It was circular and armored, more or less resembling the shell of a tortoise, and was powered by a special turbojet engine, also flat and circular, whose principles of operation recalled the well-known allopile of Hero, which generated a great halo of luminous flames. Hence, it was named Feuerball or Fireball. It was unarmed and pilotless. Radio controlled at the moment of takeoff, it then automatically followed enemy aircraft, attracted by their exhaust flames, and approached close enough without collision to wreck their radar gear. The fiery halo around its perimeter, caused by a very rich fuel mixture, and the chemical additives that interrupted the flow of electricity by over-ionizing the atmosphere in the vicinity of the plane, generally around the wingtips or tail surfaces, subjected the H2S radar on the plane to the action of powerful electrostatic fields and electromagnetic impulses, the latter generated by large klystron radio tubes protected with special anti-shock and anti-heat armor. Since a metal carrying an oscillating current of the proper frequency, equal, that is, to the frequency used by the radar station, can cancel the blips, return signals from the target, the Feuerball was almost undetectable by the most powerful American radar of the time, despite its nighttime visibility. In addition, the builders of the device hoped, and their hopes were fulfilled, that when the Allied fighters, not knowing their nature or purpose, noticed that the fiery balls were apparently harmless, they would not fire on those enormous-looking, because of their large halos of fire, quote, inoffensive, unquote, devices, for fear of being caught in some gigantic explosion. More than once, in fact, as they fearfully watched those huge lights close in, the American pilots thought that some German technician on the ground was perhaps getting ready to push a button and cause the Foo Fighters to explode. Project Feuerball was first constructed at the aeronautical establishment at Wiener Neustadt with the help of the Flugfunk Forschungsanstalt of Oberpfaffenhofen, or FFO, insofar as radio control of the missile was concerned, but was it really a missile? One person, this is very important, one person who saw the first short test flights of the device without its electrical gear says that, quote, during the day, it looked like a shining disc spinning on its axis, and during the night, it looked like a burning globe, unquote. Again, quote, during the day, it looked like a shining disc spinning on its axis, and during the night, it looked like a burning globe, unquote. Hermann Göring inspected the progress of the work a number of times, for he hoped, as in fact it happened, that the mechanical principle could later also be used to produce an offensive weapon capable of revolutionizing the whole field of aerial warfare. When the Russians began to press on toward Austria, the construction of the first fireballs was apparently continued by a number of underground plants in the Schwarzwald that were run by the Zeppelinwerke. The Klystron tubes were supplied by the section of Forschungsanstalt der Deutschen Reichspost, or FDRP, of Ack bei Ratzelfell on Lake Constance, and later also by the FDRP section of Galeberg, whose products, however, were not as perfect as those delivered by the FDRP, a fact that caused a number of fireballs to be used simultaneously in formation. Now, again, we're not talking about science fiction. We're not talking about theoretical concepts. We're talking about historical development, and we're talking about machines which were flying in the Earth's atmosphere almost a half a century ago. And just think of what may have been developed in the half century since. That's something I'm going to go into in just a minute. Now, the next thing that I'm going to go into here, again, relying on Vesco's text, concerns the development of the Kugelblitz, or ball lightning. Now, the Kugelblitz was a machine which was developed. It represented what Hermann Göring had hoped to develop. Hermann Göring, of course, the former chief of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, during World War II. He had hoped that the same basic principle could be applied to an offensive weapon, and in fact, one was developed, something called the Kugelblitz, or ball lightning. That was only used once or twice in combat. The descriptions of those provided by Vesco as follows. Quote, in a chapter, chapter 5, called Revolutionary German Anti-Aircraft Weaponry, we find the following. Quote, the circular German fighter without wings or rudder suddenly overtook the four-engine Liberator, crossing its flight path at very high speed. When it passed in front of the formation, it gave off a number of little bluish clouds of smoke. A moment later, the American bombers mysteriously caught fire, exploding in the air while the German, quote, rocket had already disappeared over the horizon. And again, he begins this eyewitness, a German, an Allied intelligence observer. The circular German fighter without wings or rudder suddenly overtook the four-engine Liberator, crossing its flight path at very high speed. And Vesco goes on after that paragraph. This astonishing combat, if it can be called that, between the very latest type of interceptor and a group of flying fortresses that had detached themselves from the main group and were heading towards southern Bavaria, took place within a matter of seconds in the sky over Württemberg. The date is unspecified, but it must have been around the end of March or the beginning of April 1945. A sketchy account of the event had been included in a report on the latest developments of the German anti-aircraft industry written by a Gaullist French diplomat living in Switzerland. This report, together with other restricted documents, was destined for the intelligence service of the general headquarters in Algiers and was clearly the work of an informer operating on the German side of Lake Constance. In the same report, there were even a mention of certain, quote, methane anti-aircraft bombs, unquote, that the Germans had experimented with on Lake Garda against another formation of flying fortresses with results about the same as those of the first. Intercepted by Italian agents, the report was deciphered by the SID, the Servizio Informazioni Difeso, the Defense Intelligence Service, in Castiglione del Stivieri, while the Allies were pushing to break through the Po Valley defenses. Shortly afterwards, it made up part of the loot seized by intelligence service agents following the British 8th Army. The event was not completely unknown to the Allied investigators. When Dr. Goebbels attempted to allay the fears caused by the terrible bombardment of Dresden by resuming his propaganda campaign, promising that powerful and still unknown anti-aircraft weapons would soon be in use, both the intelligence service and the OSS managed to obtain a short report of a test made with the sort of weapon that could perhaps explain the mysterious disappearance of a dozen four-engine American planes during their flight into Germany from a British base. This report, which also seemed to come from an informer in Switzerland, reported in fact that, quote, a strange flying machine, hemispherical or at any rate circular in shape, attacked them at a fantastic speed, destroying them in a few seconds without using any guns. Again, this report quoted, a strange flying machine, hemispherical or at any rate circular in shape, attacked them at a fantastic speed, destroying them in a few seconds without using any guns, unquote. Now, this weapon obviously was only used a few times. One of the things that Vesco does, and that is really excellent, is he goes into the development of a number of different German technologies during the closing years of World War II, And what apparently this Kugelblitz used as a weapon was a form of liquefied methane or fire damp that's often found in coal mines. Basically, it flew out in front of the bombers, released puffs of liquefied methane, which, when they hit the spark plugs of the engines of the bombers, obviously it ignited and caused the planes to explode. And he goes into the development of so-called blower cannons and the use of methane bombs and things of that kind. Now, again, what we're talking about is the historical record of circular flying machines, a long way, no doubt, from the current technologies being employed. But circular flying machines, not built by things from another world, but built by human beings right here on this one almost a half century ago. Now, Vesco goes on to describe other experiments being conducted by the British as well as the Americans during the British as well as the Germans during World War II. And one of the things that he goes into is the development of so-called suction wing aircraft. And he makes an excellent case that, in fact, in all probability, suction wing aircraft were developed into the first real so-called flying saucers. And again, not developed by creatures from another world, but developed by creatures from this world and developed a long time ago. One of the things that Vesco goes into is the development, again, of the suction wing aircraft in relation to conquering the boundary layer. Now, the boundary layer is that layer of any medium which impinges directly on an object moving through it. When you're driving a car, virtually all of the gas that you give your car over 40 miles an hour is used to overcome the wind resistance to your car. You've no doubt seen the 18-wheelers with those airfoils over the cab. That may look sort of funny, but in fact, on a long-distance haul, having that airfoil, which greatly reduces the atmospheric drag on the 18-wheeler, adds significantly to the fuel economy and consequently to the profits of the trucking firm or individual if it's an independent, and that's why you see those things on the trucks. Now, in the 1930s, aeronautical engineers, both in Britain and in Germany, were working on conquering the so-called boundary layer. And one of the things that they had come up with was the idea of quote, blowing, unquote, the boundary layer, or basically sucking it in. They began experimenting with what were known as suction wings. They discovered that the boundary layer was easiest to control in the area around the wing of an aircraft. So at first they began experimenting with aircraft wings with perforations along the leading edge of the wing to suck in the boundary layer, again, that layer of the air impinging directly on the wing, as it was being formed. Later, they began experimenting with something called Luftschwamm, or literally air sponge or flight sponge. What this involved was a process called sintering. Basically, pieces of metal were stuck together with a rosin, heated till they fused together to form basically what was a metallic sponge, although apparently solid. In fact, it was an aeropermeable metallic surface, in some ways similar to the ball on a ballpoint pen. What Vesco talks about is the experiments that were conducted both by the British and the Germans, and he develops a very credible hypothesis from both some of the eyewitness accounts of the so-called UFOs and from the development of suction-winged aircraft, that what ultimately was developed was a type of flying wing. Now, people have no doubt seen frisbees thrown about. Everybody has played with a frisbee or seen somebody playing with a frisbee. A frisbee is a circular airfoil. Basically, it's a flying wing. You get it to fly straight by getting it to spin. What Vesco points out is that the experiments on aircraft involving the sucked-in or blown boundary layer indicated that for a variety of very technical reasons, it was not expedient to have blown wings or suction wings on regularly shaped aircraft. However, if you took an aircraft which was all wing, that basically would be much, much more expeditious to use as a suction wing aircraft. And what Vesco develops, and I'm telescoping his argument here because it's very complex and takes a much longer section of text than I could read to you. He basically contends that what they did was they took a circular airfoil, which could be thought of as appearing to be something like a frisbee, and that they housed a turbine inside of it. Now, a turbine is what you see in the front of a jet engine, and I would recommend that people go down to either San Jose or SFO and take a look at a jet engine. What you'll see is a turbine, a multi-bladed propeller in the beginning of the engine. The way that a jet engine works, and a supercharger in a car works in a similar fashion, it sucks in the air, develops a tremendous suction of the air, so that you get a tremendous amount of oxygen mixed with the fuel mixture. When ignited, that produces an enormous explosion and creates the tremendous thrust that comes out of a jet engine, much greater and much more effective propellant than a propeller aircraft, in which basically a propeller propels an aircraft by chewing its way through the atmosphere. It actually takes a bite out of the air and pulls the plane through the air. With a jet engine, the turbine sucks a tremendous amount of air into the engine where it mixes with the fuel. When ignited, it produces an enormous explosion and a tremendous propulsive blast out the back of the jet. What Vesco contends is that an aircraft was developed, and again, it's very technical, but very well documented. He contends that what they did was they took a circular airfoil. The top half of the aircraft, basically, we could think of this as the top curved surface of the Frisbee, was made of sintered metal. The turbine, instead of being in the front of the jet engine and going around like this, was laid on its side and was inside of the aircraft, basically spinning in a direction that would be parallel to the ground. And that the intake of this jet engine, this modified sort of jet engine, was the entire surface of the aircraft. You have a tremendously powerful turbine, or perhaps a series of turbines, I can't say, and he does not specify. But inside of the aircraft, sucking in the boundary layer as fast as it is formed so that the aircraft has no wind resistance. People know that things fly much faster in outer space than they do here on Earth. If there was no wind resistance, then an object flying through the Earth's atmosphere could, or no atmospheric resistance, I should say, could develop flight characteristics at least in some way similar to what we can generate in outer space, and things fly much faster in outer space. So in thinking of what in all probability was the immediate post-World War II development of, quote, flying saucers, imagine a Frisbee, okay, obviously with a solid bottom. The top half, the curved portion, is made out of sintered metal. That is the air intake for this form of jet engine. A turbine or turbines are moving around inside, sucking in the boundary layer of the atmosphere as fast as it is developed, and instead of expelling it out the back, one exhaust, there are a series of nozzles around the periphery of the aircraft which can be rotated at 360 degrees around their axis and fired in any degree of arc around the circumference of the aircraft. The aircraft, in order to get it to fly straight, would be spinning, and you'd have a gyroscopically stabilized cabin. Obviously, if the thing's going to spin, you can't have the pilot going around like this. It's not going to work too good. But just imagine this. You know, take a look at a jet engine at an airport, on a commercial airliner. Take a look at that multi-bladed propeller, that turbine in the front of it. Imagine that sitting inside of a Frisbee. Obviously, the bottom of the Frisbee would be closed. The Frisbee is made out of sintered metal, and there are a series of nozzles around the periphery of the aircraft. These would be the exhaust, and those nozzles can be rotated at around 360 degrees around their axis, and they can be fired at any sequence of arc, any degree of arc around the periphery of the aircraft. And you have a gyroscopically stabilized cabin. You would have an aircraft that could fly much, much faster than anything that we had ever conceived of, because there would be no wind resistance. The air, the boundary layer of the atmosphere would be sucked into it as fast as it could form, and in turn, the exhaust would be expended around the periphery of the aircraft, and you could turn the nozzles at a 360 degrees around their axis. You could have them fired off on one side or behind it or in front of it or off to this side, and so the aircraft could perform like this. It could move like this. It could go up. It could go down. You can basically think of it as a cross between a jet engine, a Frisbee, and a helicopter. One dandy piece of aeronautical engineering and applied physics, but not something which needs to have been developed by, quote, ETs, unquote, or our brothers from space, quote, unquote. One of the things Vesco points out is that a number of eyewitness accounts of aircraft that UFOs that had crossed contrails made by aircraft, as the UFO crossed the contrail, and this is again in the immediate post-World War II period, the contrail was observed to have been cut through by the aircraft. This would have been as the suction wing aircraft moved through it actually bit a piece, it cleaved a section right out of the contrail, that visible part that you say, visible trail that you see behind an aircraft flying in the upper atmosphere. That, in all probability, was what the very first UFOs were. Again, a dandy piece of technology, hell of a piece of aeronautical engineering and applied physics, but nothing that cannot be conceived of by human beings. And after having read Vesco's account, it really sort of blew the entire notion of ETs or anything from outer space. This is something that, if I can understand it, and I'm not a physicist and I'm not technologically well-versed, it's something that I think we can assume was developed on a fairly wide scale. Now, Vesco believes that these things were developed by the British, in all probability developed by the Avro Company, the A.V. Roe Company, a Canadian subsidiary of Hawker Siddeley, a British aircraft manufacturer. Many people might be familiar with the Hawker Hurricane. That was actually the mainstay of the British Air Force during the Battle of Britain. The Spitfire was the better-known aircraft, but during the earlier stages of the Battle of Britain, it was actually the Hawker Hurricane which carried most of the burden of combat against the Luftwaffe. One of the things Vesco points out, and he documents that the United States Air Force and the Canadian Air Force were working on developing a circular flying machine, basically a, quote, flying saucer, unquote, that was going to be deployed in the middle or late 1950s. And, in fact, the so-called Avro car, again to be developed by the A.V. Roe Corporation, the so-called Avro car was actually test flown, and although it supposedly was never deployed in long-distance upper atmospheric flights, in fact, a great many commercial and military pilots saw so-called flying saucers, which very closely resembled the so-called Avro car. What I'm going to read next, and I've read this before on the program, is a statement made on October 25th, 1955, almost 37 years ago to the day. And this statement comes from the U.S. Secretary of the Air Force at the time, a guy named Donald Quarles, Q-U-A-R-L-E-S. And we're going to hear a press statement released by Donald Quarles to the general public about the development of the Avro car. And in a section that Vesco calls the Quarles Statement, on October 29, 1955, Air Force Secretary Donald Quarles released a statement through the press office of the Department of Defense permitting the ATIC to divulge some of the conclusions it had reached after its investigation of the UFOs. Among other things, Quarles declared, quote, We are now entering a period of aviation technology. Now, this is 1955, okay, that's almost 40 years ago. Quote, we are now entering a period of aviation technology in which aircraft of unusual configuration and flight characteristics will begin to appear. The Air Force will fly the first jet-powered vertical rising airplane in a matter of days. We have another project under contact with Avro Limited of Canada, which could result in disc-shaped aircraft, somewhat similar to the popular concept of a flying saucer. While some of these may take novel forms, such as the Avro project, they are direct-line descendants of conventional aircraft and should not be regarded as supernatural or mysterious. Vertical rising aircraft capable of transition to supersonic horizontal flight will be a new phenomenon in our skies, and under certain conditions could give the illusion of the so-called flying saucer. The Department of Defense will make every effort within the bounds of security to keep the public informed of these developments so they can be recognized for what they are. Quote, and then now next, Vesco puts Quarles' statement in italics. I think we must recognize that other countries also have the capability of developing vertical rising aircraft, perhaps of unconventional shapes. However, we are satisfied at this time that none of the sightings of so-called flying saucers reported in this country were in fact aircraft of foreign origin. Unquote. Whether it was deliberate or merely a slip, even the newspapers failed to catch it, Quarles got his tenses all wrong. He was talking about aircraft of the near future, while the flying discs belong to the past and not a very recent past at that. According to news stories in the American papers, the new Avro project was the latest Frost project and was described as an aircraft resembling a plate turned upside down. Finally, with 180 adjustable nozzles distributed around its perimeter, that would make vertical takeoff possible, and then, by changing the angles of the nozzles, enable the craft to move forward, sideways, or backwards, skipping down. Talking about an alleged demonstration of the Avro car for Field Marshal Montgomery of El Alamein fame, the Battle of El Alamein, for openers, Field Marshal Montgomery was involved again. It was said that he had been given a model of the new machine. A few weeks later, another, quote, well-informed, unquote, but anonymous source boldly declared that England had a considerable fleet of flying saucers at the ready in Canada, and that Field Marshal Montgomery had been present at recent, highly secret maneuvers of these craft. Quote, these machines, unquote, the cautious reporter wrote, quote, were built by A.V. Rowe and then shipped to a special secret airfield in the center of the country, unquote. Now, again, supposedly the Avro car was never deployed, that it just was an experimental aircraft, never really used in any serious fashion. But what we've just heard is a press statement, a press release by the U.S. Secretary of the Air Force almost 40 years ago. Now, one of the things that we have to think about is what we have seen in the Cold War period. The Cold War really began immediately after World War II, and it has entailed the better part of a half century of intensified technological research, much of it secret. If we think about the advances in aviation that were made between the flight of the Wright brothers in 1903 and 1943, when the first V-1 rocket bombs were falling on London, we've seen an enormous acceleration in the development of aviation in 40 years. Well, it's been more than almost 50 years since the end of World War II. It has been almost 40 years since Donald Quarles made that statement. In other words, it is a period of time almost equal to the period of time elapsed between the flight of the Kitty Hawk in 1903 and the first large-scale use of the V-1 flying bomb during World War II. In 1943, the Germans first successfully flew the Heinkel 163, the very first jet-powered plane, soon followed by the Messerschmitt 262. If we think about the acceleration in the development of tactical combat aircraft in the World War II period, at the beginning of World War II in 1939, the state-of-the-art interceptor aircraft was the Messerschmitt 109, which was under research and development in the early 1930s. By the end of World War II, the state-of-the-art experimental technology concerned the Feuerball and the Kugelblitz. In the Cold War period, we have seen almost 50 years of accelerated and largely secret technological development, and yet we have been told that there have been no significant advances in aviation made. We still have rockets and jet planes, albeit much more sophisticated, much more powerful rockets and jet planes, yet with the exception of the application of computer technology to rockets and jet aircraft, we are told that there have been no major advances in almost a half century of accelerated technological research. Well, personally, I wouldn't bet on that. I think that having seen Quarles' statement almost 40 years ago, again, an historical period almost equal to the historical period, or almost the equivalent of the historical period that elapsed between the flight of the Kitty Hawk and the first use of the V-1s, I think we have to be on the alert for the very distinct possibility that there have been major breakthroughs in aviation technology, which would appear to us, the unknowing, as obviously being the product of a, quote, superior, unquote, race, obviously coming from, quote, another planet, unquote. And I'm afraid that what we can assume has probably happened in almost a half century of intensified secret research, namely the development of something entirely different, as Monty Python put it. I think we have to be ready to confront something like that in the future, perhaps in combination with other technologies, such as, again, perhaps the use of genetic engineering, holographic projection. Something Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel has been doing some work, his series was concluded a couple of months ago, was doing some research on a top-secret military base in Napa, underneath not a mountain range, but in a hilly area and deep underground. This supposedly was a contingency base for having VIPs go underground in the event of a nuclear attack. But I witness the eyewitness accounts of people living near it have, and this has been corroborated by a number of the eyewitnesses, have reported something strange. Now, I'm not going to discuss this on the air because this isn't something Harry necessarily wants talked about, but a number of the eyewitnesses, because we really can't achieve objective verification. This is anecdotal evidence, and I don't place that much credibility in that. But the people around this military installation have described seeing a beam of light shot up into the sky from the vicinity of this base, four clouds then appearing at the various compass points in the air and then drawing together. Now, I don't know what in the world, if in fact those eyewitness accounts are accurate, I don't know what in the world could produce something like that, but it sounds to me like some sort of experiment or some sort of breakthrough in applied physics beyond what the layman or laywoman could possibly conceive of. And I think we're going to have to be on the alert for the possible application of technologies far in advance of anything we have contemplated. Something else that's interesting, I recall seeing a series of articles in the New York Herald Tribune in 1955, again the same year that Donald Quarles released that press statement, referring to experimental breakthroughs in, quote, anti-gravity, unquote, technology. Now, again, I'm not a physicist, and it would be the height of pretense for me to attempt to evaluate those critically. I noticed that the articles were run for several days, and many prestigious scientists endorsed the concept that these experiments would soon result in a complete breakthrough in aviation technology. Whether that breakthrough was achieved, whether this was some sort of deception to fool the Russians, I can't say. But in almost a half century of secret military development, I think we're going to have to be on the alert for the distinct possibility that there have been machines developed way beyond our understanding or beyond what we have been led to believe exist, and that at some point we could see something which, in the event, again, suppose the ozone layer disintegrates well past the point it is now, and that's a possibility. Suppose the banks collapse. Suppose that the number of people believing in fundamentalist religions of all kinds increases. I think we may very well have a population that would be only too ready to receive, quote, our brothers in space, unquote. And at this point, you know, think about Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast. No men from Mars, no heat rays. They were broadcasting at periodic intervals that this was nothing but a radio play, and people flipped. They went off the deep end. Just imagine how people would react if we had a real visitation by real UFOs. We were told that these are creatures from outer space, a superior civilization, and that we shouldn't panic. People will believe it if the government says that. And I think at some point we're going to have to be ready for something that may not happen at once, and I can't say when it's going to happen. I may be talking about something that could happen in 2 years or something that might happen in 100 years, but I think we have to be prepared for an event unparalleled in human history that would be something like a cross between Orson Welles' War of the World broadcast, The Miracle of Fatima, and Pearl Harbor, with effects just as profound from a religious, political, and sociological standpoint as an infusion of those events would have. I'm going to conclude the formal part of the lecture this evening by just reading a few newspaper clippings of some of the things that have been appearing in the news over the last couple of years. Article from the San Francisco Chronicle of June 6th, 1990, more than 2 years ago. UPI story, Dateline Stratford, Connecticut, headlined, quote, flying saucer, unquote, vehicle unveiled. Sikorsky Aircraft unveiled yesterday an unmanned air vehicle that resembles a miniature flying saucer, which could someday be used in the war on crime. Sikorsky executives said the Cypher vehicle is being submitted for competition in the Defense Department's unmanned air vehicle program to meet U.S. military needs. Although designed for specific military surveillance, communications, and similar missions, the vehicle has great non-defense potential, said James Sikon, chief engineer and program manager for the project at Sikorsky, a major helicopter manufacturer. Civilian uses could include the forestry and utility industries, as well as law enforcement work, including efforts to counter illegal drugs and assisting in search and rescue missions. The vehicle could be a boon to law enforcement agencies as a safe and simple way to crack down on border drug smuggling, as well as aiding police surveillance in high crime areas, said Sikon. Now, if that's not a great name for an aeronautical engineer, Sikon, that's terrific. C-Y-C-O-N, sounds like a name of a company here in Silicon Valley. Just 6 feet in diameter, the Cypher is a rotary wing system with a circular shroud that gives it the appearance of a flying saucer. The Cypher will carry a payload of 130 pounds, have a 65-horsepower engine, and be able to cruise at 80 knots with an endurance of 4 hours and a ceiling of 8,000 feet. And that's just basically a helicopter with a sheath over it. Now, reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, June 5th of 1992. Again, that very same column, Down to a Science, by Kay Davidson. This particular section of the column, this UFO is leaving traces. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's classified. Something weird is flying over the southwestern United States. Witnesses have observed and photographed jet contrails shaped like beaded strings. The contrails are repeatedly interrupted by oblong, quote, puffs, unquote, perpendicular to the main trail. Naturally, Pentagon officials deny they're testing any secret aircraft, but, quote, the contrails are consistent with exhaust characteristics of several advanced propulsion concepts, such as a pulse detonation wave engine, unquote, says Aviation Week and Space Technology. An Amarillo, Texas man photographed a beaded or, quote, sausage link, unquote, contrail accompanied by a, quote, strange, loud, pulsating roar, unquote. The Cold War is over, but old soldiers never die. They just develop new weapons. Just listen. And from the Wall Street Journal of October 10th, 1990, Belgian scientists seriously pursue a triangular UFO. This is by Tom Walker, special of the Wall Street Journal, Dateline Brussels, skipping down. Eminently sober-sided burghers saw the thing. It appeared on radar screens, and Belgium's armed forces as well as UFO specialists have taken the sightings rather more seriously than Flanders headline writers. Over the summer, the Belgian Air Force and Army even organized a weekend of UFO hunting, putting two planes at the disposal of the Belgian Society for the Study of Space Phenomena, SOBEPS, and civilian scientists who were studying the phenomena. The airborne flock of intellectuals zigzagged back and forth across Wallonia chasing UFO reports. Last week, the École Royale Militaire, the Air Force training school, began computer-aided analysis of UFO photographs. Preliminary studies of these and of radar echo studies by the Free University of Brussels are expected to be disclosed this week. At the end of the month, scientists from all of Belgium's main universities are due to meet to discuss the matter. Quote, there's at least one photograph that is well worth investigating, unquote, says Leon Brennig, B-R-E-N-I-G, a nonlinear dynamics theorist at the Free University, adding that the Air Force has, quote, much better facilities than we have for this sort of thing, unquote. Professor Brennig, whose department is studying radar echoes, is a former skeptic who claims to have seen a UFO himself in the spring. And again, I want to emphasize, as I conclude the main body of the lecture, that I am not an aeronautical engineer, I am not a physicist. However, I can smell an okey-doke when I am brought next to one, and the whole question of UFOs as originating from outer space, or else being nothing but the planet Venus on an unusually bright night, that smells to me, and again, it exudes that old familiar odor. And given the sorry state of the world today, with a badly disintegrated environment and disintegrating environment, an economy that may very soon be collapsing, it isn't exactly in the best of health right now, given the fact that the United States has a rapidly deteriorating educational system, and given that the human race as a whole is, to my way of thinking, retreating to an earlier stage of cultural development in which beliefs in the irrational are growing, I think we have to be enormously careful. We, as citizens, not just of this country, but as citizens of the world, have to be on guard for something which could change our civilization forever. As Jacques Vallée said, we may awake one morning to find strangers wandering through the ruins of our civilization. So I would advise, basically, as the Wizard of Oz said, or corrupting the Wizard of Oz said, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I say pay a great deal of attention to the man behind the curtain. And what happens? What should you do if something like this happens? Well, I would advise people to communicate this information as best they can. At some point, I'm going to be doing an archive show about this, but I think it's vital that a new middle ground be established with regard to UFO research. Either, again, we're told that this is just a bunch of screwballs, either publicity hounds or people who are mistaking weather balloons for flying saucers or the planet Venus, or else we're told it's our brothers from space. We have nothing to worry about. They're going to take care of everything, so just turn over all control to them. Well, I'm saying there's a middle ground in all probability. I think the UFOs are real. I don't know whether they're suction wing aircraft or something we've never been told about, but I think we have to be very careful that the UFO phenomenon could be used to transform and to control society forever. And I think people should do what they can to disseminate the word about that. Okay? That concludes the main body of the lecture this evening. We still... Thank you.